From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with journalist Cottie Martin. She's written a semi-autobiographical novel based on her experiences as a reporter in Europe and her childhood in Hungary, where her parents were political prisoners. Also today, I'll talk with writer Julian Barnes. His novels Flaubert's Parrot and Staring at the Sun have been praised as great literature. Barnes will explain why his books also contain some of the worst writing you'll read anywhere. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the career of soprano Benita Valente, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says legends aren't what they used to be. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. With me now is journalist and novelist Cottie Martin. From 1977 to 1980, she was the ABC News correspondent in Germany. During that time, she met and married Peter Jennings, who then was also a foreign correspondent for ABC News. Martin has written a semi-autobiographical novel about coming to terms with her ethnic, religious, and political background. Martin may have looked like the all-American reporter on TV, but she grew up in Hungary, where she spent part of her childhood in a foster home for children of political prisoners. Her parents, who worked as Hungarian reporters for AP and UPI, were convicted on trumped-up charges of spying for the CIA. After her parents were released from prison, the family emigrated to the United States. This was in 1959, when Martin was 10 years old. Martin's new novel, An American Woman, is about a journalist with a background similar to hers who feels there's something buried underneath her smooth Finnish. That leads her to investigate her hidden Hungarian past. Cottie Martin is also the author of a book about Raoul Wallenberg, the Swedish diplomat who helped save thousands of Jews from the Nazis. She began her journalism career as a reporter for All Things Considered. The name of her new book is An American Woman. Cottie Martin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry. It's great to be back.
In your novel, your character says, and she's a TV journalist, and she says, my audience isn't supposed to know that I'm a highly trained impersonator of an all-American girl. Is that how you felt when you were a TV reporter?
I think I did subconsciously, not consciously, because I'm not the sort of person who can sort of put on a persona every morning like a suit of clothes. But I did, like a lot of immigrants, and I think America encourages this, like a lot of immigrants, I embraced my assimilation with such enthusiasm that I never looked back, nor did my parents want me to look back, because like many first-generation refugees, they felt that the only way that we could really make it, we came here with four suitcases, and one of the four suitcases held nothing but scrapbooks. So really, the only way that we could, quote, make it was if we didn't look back. And after a while, I did begin to feel a bit like an imposter, because I felt that eventually people would find out that I wasn't exactly what I purported to be. So I'm not, I can't say that I was a phony. That's a bit hard. But
you had a secret.
But I did have this sort of, I hadn't dealt with things that I ought to have dealt with until I was really confronted by them.
Well, what do you mean when you were confronted by them? What led you to actually investigate your own past?
Well, as you said, I was a foreign correspondent for ABC, and I was sent on assignment to Hungary to do a 5-part series on the new Hungary, because as you know, Hungary sort of is the country that's invented Glasnost long before Gorbachev did, and has really experimented in both its economy and in its social life with sort of putting a human face on socialism without beating its chest about it the way the Czechs and the Poles have done and have paid dearly for it. And the Russians have allowed Hungary a far greater margin for experimenting with socialism because of the Hungarian revolt, which I witnessed as a child, because 20,000 people did die on the streets of Budapest. So the Soviets know how far this particular satellite can be pushed before something snaps. So I was sent in. This is a very long-winded answer to your good, quick question. But I was sent in 1978 by ABC with a crew to report on the new Hungary, and I was just astonished to find that nothing had changed, and I had changed so completely. And I really was sort of incapacitated for a few days, and that's when I that's when the long journey back began, and that's when I decided that eventually I would write a book about my childhood. And I wasn't sure if it would be fiction or nonfiction, but ultimately I decided that for a woman of my somewhat tender years to write her memoirs would be a pretty pretentious thing to do.
I'm interested in what you remember from your childhood in Hungary. Do you remember when your parents were taken as political prisoners? Were you a witness to that?
Yes, I was. I for many years lived with a sort of residual guilt, in fact, for my mother's arrest, because I actually answered the door to the four secret policemen who identified themselves as meter readers. Your mother rang about the meter, they said. And I knew immediately, because a kid who grows up in that part of the world grows up faster than in this part of the world. And in many ways, I didn't really have a childhood, because in a totalitarian state, your indoctrination starts at such a young age that, I mean, I was, for example, made to join the Young Pioneers when I was six, and, you know, we marched to those revolutionary songs and so forth. But getting back to my mother's arrest, I knew that those men weren't what they claimed to be. They looked different from the blue collar types that they purported to be. Their overalls were too clean, their chests were too burly, and they were looking past me into the apartment. But that day was the first day that that this older girl who lived across the hall from us and whom I looked up to the way little girls look up to older girls deigned to come and play with me in my apartment. Later it became known that the reason she was with me on that morning was not by chance, but because her father was a lieutenant in the Hungarian equivalent of the KGB, which is called the AVO, and that her help had in fact been enlisted in the arrest of my mother. And so rather than stir any kind of alarm, I called out my mother's name and went back to my room and continued the activity of cutting up an old dress of my mother's with my so-called friend, who was in fact the ally of the so-called meter men. And didn't see my mother again for a year after that. And I used to feel a lot of guilt for that.
I want to read something that your main character says in mm-hmm. your novel when she witnesses the arrest mm-hmm. of her parents. She says, at the age of six, well, it's in third person, it says, at the age yes. of six, Anna already had a sense that arrests must be accomplished with a minimum of fuss.
Mm.
Did you feel that when you were a kid? Did you have that sense?
Yes, because I had friends who had parents who were arrested. This is, you know, these were the chilliest days of the Cold War. This was right after Stalin's death, and I knew lots of people whose parents were there one day and weren't there the next, and yet there wasn't any hysteria any place. People still, you know, lined up at the bus, and you were always lining up for something, you know, whether it was for apples or bread or postage stamps, there was always a line, and the same people would be there lining up without minus the father or minus the mother, and yet nobody ever raised their voices. So I knew that this was built into the world that I was part of, that you just these things happened, and it was a long time, for example, before I knew what happened to my mother. I just knew that she was no longer there for me.
Well, you were in a foster home for children of political mm-hmm. prisoners for a while. Were you re-educated politically while you were there?
The re-education took place in the school. The people who took care of me and my sister, although there's no sister in the novel, but just for the sake of accuracy, I did have a sister, and in fact that made a big difference because we became each other's chief support. These were sort of down and out people, pension couple, who also had a daughter who had been taken into custody, and they made extra money by taking in children like us, and in fact the Associated Press paid for our upkeep. But to me the really wrenching thing was that my parents knew that they would be arrested eventually. I mean, we grew up being told that someday they wouldn't be there because of the nature of their jobs. I mean, they knew full well that working for Western Wire Services, the AP and the UPI, as they did, was a pretty risky proposition. I mean, treasonous if they wanted to if they needed an incident. It's always in these countries, it's always when the word comes down, usually from the Kremlin, that they need to sort of blow those cold winds again. And so my parents were rounded up because Khrushchev needed a cold spell. Anyway, my mother had laid elaborate plans for our well-being while she was in prison. She had a very close childhood friend who was married to a member of the new class, a scientist who was a party man and coddled by the regime and accorded amazing privileges like a car and chauffeur and two houses and no children of their own. And when the secret police took my sister and me to their lovely villa up in the hills overlooking Buddha, she didn't want to know about us. I mean, she just said there was no such agreement and she'd be happy to send us parcels or whatever we needed. But this was my first real exposure to grown-up terror, because it was so plain to me that my sister and I had been painted with the same, tarred with the same brush as my parents, that we were, in fact, enemies of the state and that nobody wanted to have anything to do with us. And we didn't have very many friends that year. The American ambassador in Budapest paid frequent calls on us and brought us, you know, unheard of goodies like oranges and patent leather shoes, which we needed like a hole in the head. But
when your parents were released in, mm-hmm. I guess it was late 50s, the whole right. family moved to America. Did yes. you take paranoia with you when you moved here?
Inadvertently, I didn't think I had. I mean, I was just we were all so happy to be here and became so assimilated. You know, I really did become the all-American girl and a cheerleader and ran for every public office that was ever open, and became very busy and, you know, first learning English and then tackling all those adolescent problems of an American high school girl. But I suppose I must have had a lot of paranoia because a lot of it surfaced in the writing of this novel.
When you returned to Hungary as a correspondent doing this series that you mentioned
yes.
earlier, did you try to visit the prison in which your parents were jailed?
Actually, what you see on the jacket of this book is this lovely Baroque building is the prison. I didn't try to. I'm not dedicated enough to want to get past the front gate, but I did walk past there and looked up and wondered which were the cells that my parents had spent those terrible times in.
What brought on waves of recognition when you returned to Hungary?
Well, nearly everything. I mean, going back to my old house and some of the people who lived there when I lived there, for example, the concierge, the elderly lady who looks, you know, sort of the janitor, her daughter was now the new concierge, and there was actually a picture of me and my parents on her, tacked to her bedroom wall, and I was overwhelmed by the loyalty of that after so many years, and overwhelmed by the fact that in our society, that in American society, that kind of loyalty is almost unheard of. That, you know, we move on so fast here and are constantly making new friends, breaking down new barriers, moving from smaller to bigger apartments, moving on in our jobs and our professional lives. There's so much movement in our lives. It made me realize that a lot of this movement is a substitute for something else, and that in this Eastern European society, where people do not have the diversion of either ambition or stuff, consumption, because it simply ain't there, human links can be much stronger. And I found this with my old friends, too, that they had endless time for me. And I began to lose track of the hour, which is something I never do
I'll
in
bet
America.
You never do that. Yeah.
No, you're always, well, it's 10 o'clock. I've got to go. Everybody's got to get their, you know, 8 hours sleep. And so we can be, you know, so the killer instincts will be primed for the morning. Well, that's putting it a bit brutally, but you know what I mean. There isn't this sense of lifelong bonds that you feel in an Eastern European country, where really that's what keeps people sane are the human ties rather than ambition and consumption.
Did you imagine what your life would have been like had you never left Hungary?
Oh yes, yes, it would have been an extremely circumscribed life. Because I was the child of condemned spies, and that would have been stamped on me forever. It would have been a life pretty free of ambition, and in a way an enviable one. Because as a refugee, I have had I've been burdened with almost unlimited ambition. And it's always looking, particularly right now I'm living in New York in an extremely sort of fast-track life, if you will. At least that's how, you know, the glossies would describe it. And that carries with it its own burden, always pushing ahead to the next project because you feel that people are looking at you for that. I don't know how much of it comes from within me and how much of it comes from people's expectations, but certainly in Hungary I would have been freed of those particular drives.
My guest is writer Kati Martin. She's written a novel. It's her first novel. It's semi-autobiographical. It's called An American Woman. Kati, we're going to take a short break and we'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is writer Kati Martin. She's a former correspondent for ABC News and is the author of a new novel, which is titled An American Woman. You talked earlier about how when your parents came to Hungary, came to America from Hungary, they never looked back. And I'm sure they knew that you were writing this book. How do they feel about you wanting to reinvestigate the past that they had done their best to forget about and to protect you from?
Not good is the short answer. They would have preferred that I stayed with nonfiction. I don't think it's ever simple to have a writer of fiction in your family. Because, after all, what else does a writer have to draw on than his own experience? That's the clay that you mold into something. There's no writer who I know who doesn't do that. And in this book, I do deal with a great many tender topics. And I deal with them in fiction form. And there is a lot that is fiction in this book. I mean, there's a whole cast of characters who, you know, the sort of secondary characters who are entirely fictional.
Well, can I bring up one of the things that I don't know if it's fiction or real, but it certainly strikes me as very sensitive if it was real. The father in the novel has never told the daughter that he's Jewish born and that he hid that through the early years of her life. And she was brought up Roman Catholic. Did that happen in your family?
A great many sort of middle-class families in Budapest. My family had many Jewish members, which I didn't know about, and many who sadly perished during the Nazi period, which I also didn't know about, for a number of reasons, some having to do with the guilt that I think any survivor of that period feels. Some more complicated reasons, which I try to deal with in the book. I became passionately involved in this subject when I was researching my book on Raoul Wallenberg, because that was a chapter that I simply hadn't either been interested in or known much about, was the whole Jewish, the Hungarian Holocaust, which is a particularly bitter one because it was at the very end of the war, and even the most fanatical Nazi even Adolf Eichmann knew that it was a losing cause. So it was done in a great hurry. And yes, I did lose family members to that, and that came as a not in the particular way that I describe in the book, but in a different way, and that came as a wrench.
I want to quote something that the father in the novel says to the daughter when she's investigating her Hungarian past and finding out all this information about her parents. The father says, "Aren't you being a little of a voyeur, all this vicarious dramatizing, claiming your right to this history without ever having paid a price for any of it?" Mm. Did your parents' reaction parallel that at all?
Somewhat, yes.
That must have really hurt.
Yes, it did.
Mm. What was your comeback?
Well, you know, we all have ambiguous motives for everything we do, and although I felt that I had a right to my own past, and in fact, I think that, I mean, the title of my book is An American Woman, because I do believe that to be an American means to claim the past and to set the record straight, that you're really sort of play acting if you come here and you leave, if you check all your baggage at the door, all your history left behind. I think that's a very superficial kind of Americanization, and I did do that the first time around until I went back and got all the hues and tones of my heritage straight. I can say, I think with a degree of honesty, that I am an American woman because I know what my heritage is. And I think that the people who come here and with a push from our society to assimilate, and don't own up to why they had to leave all those terrible things behind, and don't incorporate that into their present persona, as I hadn't until quite recently. But I'm raising my children differently. They will know everything the way I didn't.
Well, I think many of us have or have had parents or grandparents mm-hmm. who came from another country but didn't want to talk about it.
Yes.
And for many of them, it was called the old world, the old country.
Yes. Yes.
Did your parents feel like you were dragging them back to a part of the world that they really wanted to forget, that they resent
yes,
the book?
Yes, and of course I felt guilt for that because they have lived through things that are unspeakable, and you know, both under the Nazis and then after the communists, and they spent time in prison, which is something that I hope never to do, and yet they emerged from that whole people and have given me this chance at you know, a new country and a new life, and I think I've, so far, touch wood, I've had a really very rich kind of life. So I owe them a great deal. And at the same time, I felt that there was something missing and that it was my right to do that. And hence this book, really.
So you feel a more complete person, more comfortable person.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I'm not saying that this book is self-therapy, but there is an element of that in all writing, I think, is getting down to the deepest and least illuminated corners of your persona.
My guest is writer Cottie Martin, and we're discussing the subject of her new book. It's a novel, semi-autobiographical. It's titled An American Woman. Now, you're a writer and a former broadcaster,
mm-hmm.
and your husband, Peter Jennings, is a network news anchor. It strikes me that writing is such an invisible profession compared to being on television, compared to the work you were formerly doing or the work that your husband is doing now. And I wonder if you ever have been in a position of resenting the invisibility of writing, you know, because everybody knows you walk into a restaurant, whatever, everybody knows what your husband's been doing every day because he's on TV and you could see him working, and the work you're doing is invisible until the book is published.
Yes, well, I did have this lust for bright lights when I was a bit younger and didn't know any better, and then I found out that it comes at a price like everything else. And I went first when I was a local television personality, as they called us in those days, in Philadelphia, in fact, I discovered that you pay a huge price in terms of giving up on privacy and living with Peter Jennings is a daily reminder of the price that extracts from you. And there are lots of things that Peter and I don't do because doing things with them is a lot of trouble because, I mean, it's wonderful that he has so many people who are interested in talking to him, but it makes going out to dinner, you know, virtually impossible. Because we don't talk to each other, we talk to everybody else,
right.
and so on. So we eat in a lot, and I mean that's a trivial example, but there are many others. And so I really cherish my relative anonymity, and when every few years I produce a book, it's a wonderful thing because it's really a piece of me, and then I. You know, after a couple of weeks of stumping, I can hardly wait to get back to my word processor and start squeezing my brain again.
There's one other thing I want to ask you about your marriage, and I hope you don't mind me asking this. It just strikes me when you and your husband Peter Jennings met, you were both foreign correspondents, and you were both based in Europe, mm-hmm. where people didn't see either of you every mm-hmm. night on TV. And you both had very similar jobs. When you moved back to the States, he became the anchor and became very famous, and you started writing and, mm-hmm. and left television. So you became less visible as he became
more
very visible. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if that kind of thing affected the equality, the balance of equality within the relationship. I think it's a mm-hmm. lot of it's something that a lot of couples face in a relationship, possibly on a much smaller scale. But where one person's career has taken a different route than another's and they've become more visible. Does that affect the inside of the relationship?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm candor is one of my vices. And so I'm forced to tell you that it really was quite a shock to both of us, and it's bound to affect your own self-image as well as your perception of your spouse when suddenly, you know, everybody's looking at you. And in London, as you said, we were both equally and wonderfully anonymous. And yes, we had to do some real juggling between the two of us to get our bearings. And for me, the writing has been a salvation. And he is a great champion of my writing. In fact, he was among the, I think he was the first, because he was the chief foreign correspondent when I was bureau chief for ABC in Bonn. So he saw all my scripts. And he's the one who said, your scripts are different and you should really try writing a longer piece. And that resulted in my first submission to Atlantic Monthly. Really, without that push from Peter, I might still be, you know, chasing hijackings, God forbid, or fires, because he did urge me to do that, and we've also found that it's much healthier in a couple for us to be involved in different things rather than the same thing, and for each of us to come home at the end of the day and say, oh my God, you won't believe what they, you know, the latest outrages the network perpetrated. This way, you know, one of us can listen while the other tells his tale of horror.
Well, your work has you traveling a lot. You're writing a new book about George Polk.
Yes.
And that's taking you, you're telling me, to like four continents.
Well, I do love travel, but I like travel sort of at my own speed, and that's what writing enables me to do.
Connie Martin, it's been a pleasure to talk with you, and I want to thank you very much for coming to speak with us today.
Thanks for having me, too.
My guest has been writer Connie Martin. She's the author of a new semi-autobiographical novel. It's titled An American Woman, just published by Norton. She's also a former correspondent for ABC News. She started her journalism career on All Things Considered. This is Fresh Air. On the next edition of the show, I'll speak with novelists Louise Erdrich and Michael Darris. They're married and collaborate on each other's books. Erdrich's novels are Love Medicine and The Beat Queen. Darris's new novel is A Yellow Raft in Blue Water. So I hope you can join us. Maybe Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Julian Barnes talks about his latest novel, Staring at the Sun. In it, we discover the question, does God exist, has more answers than you might think. Also today, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz examines the career of singer Benita Valente. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says there's no such thing as a living legend, and we'll get the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. American soprano Benita Valente has been singing in top opera houses and concert halls for the past 25 years. She has a devoted following, but she's never gone after superstar status. There's a new set of Valente's CDs now being released. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has this review of one of them. Benita Valente sings Lieder of Schubert, Haydn, and Mozart.
Mein Herz ist schwer, ich finde sie nimmer und nimmer mehr. Wo ich ihn nicht hab.
For 25 years, American soprano Benita Valente has been a connoisseur's delight, a musician's musician. In opera and recitals, in Europe and with practically every important orchestra or opera company in this country, including the Met. Yet she's never acquired the celebrity status of some of her equals or inferiors. Partly, I suspect, it's a matter of temperament. She projects humility and reticence rather than the aggressive glamour of the typical prima donna. She seems to care more about her music than her image, which of course is part of her charm. It's what makes her self-sacrificing Gilda in Rigoletto, for example, so convincingly youthful. And it's what must be at least partly behind the touching sweetness and transparency of her Mozart and Handel. With that tear dissolving in her voice, or the sunburst of joy, she's the ideal musical heroine. But probably the main reason for her relative obscurity outside the musical world is that she hasn't recorded much. Some 20 years ago, she made a famous record of Schubert's The Shepherd on the Rock, with Rudolf Serkin and Boston Symphony clarinetist Harold Wright. It's still a collector's item. Her few other recordings on small labels have virtually disappeared. But this situation is being remedied. Lately, she's been recording again, and the Pantheon label has been releasing a series of 4 solo records and CDs. There are Wolf and Strauss songs, Mozart and Handel arias, some vocal chamber music, mostly French and Spanish, and a wonderful album of Haydn, Mozart, and Schubert songs that includes a new version of The Shepherd on the Rock with pianist Cynthia Rehm and once again clarinetist Harold Wright, better than ever. Listen to the last few minutes of this ambitious work, possibly Schubert's last song, in which Valente and Wright capture the repressed pain and uncertainty behind the lonely shepherd's springtime optimism.
Ich bin fertig zum Morgen bereit, der Frühling.
That was Benita Valente singing Schubert. She's one of a sadly dwindling number of singers who specializes in the art of the art song. Among her teachers were Lotte Lehmann, one of the greatest lieder singers of this century. Valente's many virtues and a few limitations are present on this disc. Every so often, a vocal turn emerges a little less delicately than it might have 10 years ago, but her tone is still rich and exquisitely limpid. Her German, Italian, and even English diction is impeccable, immaculate, comprehensible without being pretentious, and that comes in handy in case no texts or translations are included with your CD. There weren't any with my copy. On the other hand, her French strikes me as a little unaromatic. Still, you can't help feeling over and over again what a superb and moving artist she is, how little she needs to sacrifice either dramatic urgency or beauty of tone, because her understanding of both the music and the words seems to spring from the same expressive impulse.
Our music critic Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He's a poet and teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is British writer Julian Barnes. 2 years ago, he captured American readers with the publication of his novel Flaubert's Parrot. Critics praised Barnes for his imaginative blending of fiction and biography. Barnes was working as a TV critic in England when Flaubert's Parrot was published here. His two previous novels, Metroland and Before She Met, are now available in this country. But fans will have to wait for his crime stories, written under the pen name Dan Cavanaugh, to appear in American bookstores. Barnes' new book is called Staring at the Sun. The novel follows the life of a young woman, beginning in 1921 and ending 100 years later.
This excerpt comes from the early part of the book, where the heroine, Jean Sargent, is a naive young woman about to get married. And one of the wiser women of the village has given her a book on sexology to break the news to her gently. The first night, she leafed through the book carelessly, skipping whole chapters called Sleep, Children, Society, and Appendix. If she did this, it didn't really count as reading. Even so, phrases dropped from the page and stuck like burrs to her flannelette nightdress. Some of them made her laugh, some of them made her apprehensive. The word turgid kept appearing, and so did crisis. She didn't like the sound of those two. Enlarged and stiffened, she read. Lubricated by mucus, turgid again, soft, small, and drooping, ugh. Maladjustment of the relative shapes and positions of the organs. The clitoris corresponds morphologically to the man's penis. What could that mean?
In your novels, you seem to really take great joy both in wonderful writing and in very funny or very inspired flourishes, but also you seem to really get a kick out of bad writing. I mean, you quote...
Other people's bad writing.
Other people's bad writing.
Let's get this straight.
No, yeah. That's right. If it was your own bad writing, it would be a little enjoyment to be had. No, but in Flaubert's Parrot and in your new book, Staring at the Sun, there are several passages where you're quoting somebody else's bad writing, and it's really very funny, and I know that as the writer, you're really enjoying it yourself.
Yes, that's true. I mean... I was very attracted actually by this bad writing in this book of sexology because, I mean, there's a lot of bad writing which doesn't really mislead or misleads about unimportant things or low levels of experience. But there's something, it seems to me, not just funny, but deeply poignant about the idea of someone not knowing anything about sex and trying to learn it from books which use words like, you know, lubricated by mucus. You know, that sounds like something pretty nasty.
I have a feeling you have a real love-hate relationship with words.
Oh, I don't know where you get the idea of the hate part of it. I mean, I have a love relationship with words. One of my earliest jobs was as a lexicographer on the Oxford English Dictionary.
Really?
Yes, I worked there for 3 years. So I suppose I'm particularly skilled in words beginning with letters A to G, which came into our language between 1880 and 1975, but I don't think it shows in my prose.
Well, I'll tell you why I thought you might hate language as well as love it.
Yes.
First of all, your main character at one point talks, I forget exactly what the quote is, but she says sometimes she gets fed up with words.
Yes.
And one of your great literary idols, I don't know if that's too strong a word, is Flaubert, who was obsessed with words and with le mot juste, with the right word, and I think that could be torture as well as fulfilling.
Yes, I see what you mean. I mean, if you're obsessed with using words as precisely and perfectly as you can, then at some point you're bound to sort of butt up against the sort of the extremities of the use of words. You know, that at some point words don't cover the whole of experience.
You are known now as one of the great literary talents of our time. Now, you actually wrote a couple of mysteries under a pseudonym. When was that?
Oh, that was contemporaneous with starting to write under my own name.
Why didn't you use your name for the mysteries?
Well, I tell you what I said to myself at the time. I wrote a book under my own name, and then I wrote a mystery, and then I wrote another mystery, and then I wrote another book under my own name. And I thought that it was a sort of courtesy, you know, to the reader who picks up one sort of book and then picks up another and finds it's completely different, that it would be a good idea to separate the identities.
To a lot of people, being literary means that you read books, but you don't read mysteries and you don't watch TV. That's pop. That's something separate from literature. Do you have any problem with combining the two? And do you think any of your, you know, readers would think less of you if they thought of you as a television critic and mystery writer as well as a great novelist?
I think some might. No, I don't feel that I'm sort of slumming or anything by writing or reading mysteries or watching television. I mean, it's the idea of sort of high art being sort of exclusive seems to me very arid, and that you end up very soon in a cul-de-sac where there are beautifully written books which don't relate to life at all and are read as escapism by moneyed people. I'm not interested in that sort of writing at all.
You seem to be interested in riddles and hypotheses and unanswerable questions. There's a lot of those in your new book.
In the new book there is, and indeed it was originally called Question and Answer. One diligent critic in England counted up the number of question marks there were in the book, and I think he
How
came
many
to
were
sort of,
there?
Well, I think he came to 500 or 600, but I haven't done the count myself.
It's an interesting form of literary criticism.
That's right. Yes, I think he probably just tried it for about 20 pages, and then he multiplied by 10 or something like that. But it makes a fair point.
You devote more than a couple of pages to answers to the question, "Is there a God?"
Yes, that's right. Towards the end of the book, the son of the questioning Gene Sargent gets obsessed by. We've now moved forward to the next century, and he gets obsessed by the question of whether God exists or not, and so he sets out a sort of series of hypotheses.
Would you read a few?
Yes, sure. Well, we start with the two obvious ones. One, that God exists. Two, that God does not exist. Three, that God used to exist, but doesn't anymore. Four, that God does exist, but that he's abandoned us. A, because we've been a severe disappointment to him, or B, because he gets bored easily. Five, that God did exist, doesn't exist at the moment, but will exist again in the future. He's merely taking a divine sabbatical at the moment. This would explain a lot. Six, that God hasn't existed so far at all, but will exist in the future. He will arrive at some point to clear away our garbage, trim the grass in the public parks and gentrify the neighbourhood. God is an overworked maintenance man in a stained boiler suit, with far too many planets to look after. We should consider paying more and having a regular maintenance contract instead of calling him out on an emergency basis as we do now. And one more, if we've got time for it, that there are several gods. This might explain a lot. A, they might always be quarrelling, and so no one is minding the shop. B, they might be paralysed by an excess of democracy, like the United Nations. Each god has a veto, and so nothing gets past the Security Council. Small wonder that our planet is derelict. C, this subdivision of responsibility has weakened their strength and weakened their concentration. They might be able to see what is going wrong, and yet do nothing about it. Perhaps the gods are benign but powerless. Perhaps they can merely look on like eunuchs in a harem.
How did you come up with those answers to the question, does God exist?
Well, I just sat down and thought of them, actually. I certainly didn't go reading through religious philosophy and so on to find examples. I think I got one of them from a pamphlet on heresy or something like that I did look up. I ran them through a friend of mine who's a philosopher to see if he could come up with any more possibilities, but he couldn't add any to them. It's a game, but it's a serious game when you do something like that, and it's the sort of bursts of writing that I like doing very much.
Okay, Julian Barnes, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Julian Barnes' new novel is titled Staring at the Sun. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories do you have for us today?
Well, we're following the resumption of the Iran-Contra hearings, and we'll also be hearing what some of America's allies in Europe think about the suggestion that they share in the security burden of the Persian Gulf. The reaction is not very positive.
Who are you speaking with?
Among other people, with one of the state of Maryland's Adult Education Students of the Year. He is a prisoner at the Maryland Correctional Institute, and we'll be talking about his favorite poem, among other things.
Which is?
The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost.
Okay, thank you. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Achieving legendary status is much easier than it used to be, but our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says that's really just a linguistic cheap trick.
I learned from One Day Sports page a couple of weeks ago that the new coach of the Sacramento Kings would be basketball legend Bill Russell, that another hoops legend, Julius Erving, was about to make his last NBA appearance, and that the Cincinnati Reds had moved into first place in the National League West, under the tutelage of diamond legend Pete Rose. Over the next few days, I found further references to rock and roll legend Jerry Lee Lewis, to country music legend Mickey Gilley, and to Motown legend Marvin Gaye. A TV ad promotes the legendary fit of Levi's jeans. I found an outboard motor and a designer chair, both calling themselves legends, and three legendary cars. Mind you, this is not counting another car that's actually named the legend, which has been in production for all of a year or so, and which cost about $10,000 more than a mere celebrity. The word legend has a somewhat roundabout history. Originally, it comes from Latin legenda, meaning that which is to be read. That explains why we still use the word to refer to the writing in the corners of maps and the like. In the Middle Ages, a legend was primarily a story of the life of a saint. From there, it acquired its modern sense of a story about remote and undocumented events which has been handed down through the ages by oral tradition. The subjects of legends don't have to be as remote as Robin Hood or King Arthur, of course. The early unrecorded blues musicians are genuinely legendary, and so too are those baseball players from the days before film or reliable record-keeping, like Cap Anson or Wee Willie Keeler. In the 20th century, however, genuinely legendary heroes have become a little thin on the ground, if only because we have the media around to document every event worth noting, and then some. Strictly speaking, there's nothing legendary about the deeds of Bill Russell or Pete Rose. You can be sure that every rebound and every hit is recorded on a piece of film somewhere. But of course, when people call someone a legend nowadays, they don't mean that his deeds or existence are undocumented. What people want to say about Bill Russell and Pete Rose is simply that they did such extraordinary things that no one will ever forget them. Now, we used to have a perfectly good word for this. We called such people famous. But fame is an inflated currency now, thanks to the power of those same media that made real legends obsolete. Vanna White is famous, and so are Ed McMahon, Fawn Hall, and the guy who makes Remington razors. Everybody gets to be famous for 15 minutes, as Andy What's-His-Name said. So what do we do when we want to honor someone whose fame is based on a genuine public recognition of merit? Why, we take a word that denotes the kind of enduring fame bestowed by word of mouth alone, the fame of legend. The irony is that the word legend itself is debased in the process. Once the media start to describe something as legendary, we can't tell whether its fame has a real popular base or whether it's just another creature of media hype. This is the paradox described by the critic Leo Brody in his recent History of Fame, suggestively titled The Frenzy of Renown. As Brody puts it, to be talked about is to be part of a story, and to be part of a story is to be at the mercy of storytellers.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University.
On his marching now in the legend of the West, one name stands out of all the rest. The man who had the fastest gun, his name was Bat, Bat Master's son.
Here's a preview of our next program. Next time, I'll speak with Jay Tarsis. He's the creator of the new NBC TV series, The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will discuss the recent commercialization of the Beatles, from the use of the song Revolution in the Nike commercial to Ringo's endorsements for wine coolers. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Beverly Hills Cop 2. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.